From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. There's still a lot we don't know about the Zika virus, but many people in Georgia are working on it right now. Today, we'll talk about what's being done here and get some recommendations on how to avoid infection. Plus, speaking of medicine, we'll talk about folk medicine traditions that are still alive in a small community off of Georgia's coast. Does your family have unconventional remedies for what ails you? Vicks VapoRub was pretty much this cure for everything in my family, but what about a little goose grease on the chest to soothe a cold?
And we Schrutes use every part of the goose. The meat has a delicious, smoky, rich flavor. Plus, you can use the molten goose grease and save it in the refrigerator, thus saving you a trip to the store for a can of expensive goose grease. Wow, win-win. Exactly. Thank you, Jim.
That's all coming up this hour. First, though, let's go back to the break room for just a moment. We talked about a lot of things on Friday, including whether Atlanta is a saintly or sinful place. The conversation was inspired by something that Glenn Beck said. He made a list of, quote, godless cities.
Number 15 is, surprise, surprise, St. Louis. 14 is Washington, D.C. Coming in at number 13 with a bullet is Las Vegas.
So how about Georgia's cities? Here are your first thoughts.
My name is Andrea. I'm in Thomaston, Georgia. Concerning whether Atlanta is sinly or saintly and the contradiction, Georgia has had so much sin that it has been forced to become saintly to counteract the sin.
Andrea, you weren't really all that specific about what you're talking about there, so you can call us back to let us know what you mean, but we'd love to get your opinions. Call us back at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter, at OST Talk, or you can find us on Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. When people get sick, most people will reach for cough syrup or ibuprofen immediately. But in the Gullah community, many people might reach for an herb called Life Everlasting instead. It's boiled into a tea by the Gullah Geechee people on Georgia's coast, and it treats congestion and coughs. Folk remedies like this are used less and less today, but one store in Hilton Head hopes to keep the Gullah Geechee medicinal tradition alive. Lynn Revere is the owner of Back to Nature, and she joins me now. Good morning, Lynn.
Good morning.
Also with us is Tierra Banks. She wrote her master's thesis about Gullah Geechee medicine, and it is fascinating. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And you also, Tierra, your family is, your grandmother is Gullah?
My godmother.
Your godmother is Gullah. Mm-hmm. Let me go to you first, Lynn. What's the most, the best-selling herb that you have?
I would say that peppermint is probably the leading herb that we sell.
And sold in like a leaf form or a peppermint oil, or how do people buy it?
They mostly buy it in the form of an essential oil because it can easily be applied to the area of concern. For example, a headache, stomach ache, or any kind of arthritic pain in a certain area, they could simply apply the oil directly to the area.
And supposedly I've read that the smell of mint actually counters fatigue and can improve your brain function, which is kind of fascinating. But Tierra, one of the reasons that you focused on folk medicine among the Gullah community is because it's beginning to disappear. Is that right?
That's correct.
How quickly could we see some of these traditions go?
Pretty quickly. I know during my research, out of the 20 participants, most of them were well into over the age of 60. So that lets you know that the younger generation is somewhat shying away from it. It's not being passed down amongst generations as it was years ago or generations ago.
Lynn, do you see that as well, that it's older people that come in to get folk remedies?
Not really. What I see is that the herbs are probably being practiced and used less in the Gullah culture, but there are different cultures that are increasingly coming into the store and buying different essential oils and medicinal herbs.
I wonder, Tierra, if one of the things that you noticed was that people are both going to a traditional doctor, right, and then also using folk remedies. Is that one way to keep it from disappearing, is by helping it to merge a little more comfortably with modern medicine?
Yes, most of my participants that I did interview did utilize a dual healthcare system, meaning they did go to the doctor, they did have a doctor, and they did also use traditional medicine. What I found out, though, was that most of them were not discussing this use of traditional medicine with the doctor. So that's where a lot of my research come in. It's almost somewhat like it was a hidden secret amongst the population.
Maybe because they didn't want to get scolded.
Right. Didn't want to get scolded and didn't want to, you know, be told to shy away from it. They, you know, they trust it. Somewhat more than the westernized medicine, because it's been passed down amongst generations, their grandmothers, you know, grandfathers, it's been passed down. So it's a trusted way of treating illnesses.
Well, Lynn, give me an example of a remedy, say, for a mosquito bite. We're going to talk about mosquitoes in this show. So if I get a mosquito bite, what do I put on it?
Well, commonly you would use lavender, for example. It's something that you would use, or even cedar wood.
See, I just rub wood on it?
Just rub apply the lavender oil.
And then rub
lavender
the wood.
Lavender is used for calming and relaxing, and also for scratches, bruises.
Tira, did you grow up using any of these? Did your godmother use any of these remedies on you?
Not that I know of. My family use a lot of herbs. So we use sassafras tea for colds, asafoetida. So we use a lot of herbal remedies. I did use the one that I was told about that I didn't know growing up. We used the copper for a ringworm that you get, like a copper penny, put it on a ringworm. So
does that work?
It did work when I was growing up as a kid and was out playing and got ringworms. So those are some of the things. We used pork for puncture wounds. So my grandmother did. We used a lot of things that were in her kitchen growing up.
Now, you're right. In the medical profession now, are you not?
I do cancer research, yes.
Okay, so you probably work with a lot of people who, if you tell them that you use those things growing up, they probably think that's fun. I'm sure they don't take it seriously.
Probably not. Probably not.
Do you talk about these things with your fellow?
I talk about them amongst my employees, not so much with the doctors and the nurses. They probably.
Why not?
They might shy away from it. I do think that it's, you know, they would probably advise to use something else.
Lynn, do you find that Tiara was saying that many of the people that she spoke to would go to the regular doctor but wouldn't tell them they were also using folk remedies? Have you found that to be the case?
Well, sometimes, yes. Sometimes people will tell me that they don't let their doctor know that they're using natural remedies. But I always advise people that if you don't really know what your condition is or the problem is, that you should definitely see a physician, a licensed physician, and get some screening, testing, or whatever is necessary.
So you will actually advise people to go to the doctor. Is there resistance to that?
No, because lots of people are looking for a quick fix. Say, for example, someone will walk in the door and say, what do you have for diabetes? So I would let them know, we don't just have something for diabetes that's going to cure your diabetes. Actually, you would have to focus on more than just a magic herb. You would have to detox the body, change your diet. And, of course, if you don't know exactly what's going on with your body, you actually need to see a medical doctor and get an examination.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Lynn Rivera, the owner of the store Back to Nature in Hilton Head, and Tiara Banks wrote her master's thesis on Gullah Geechee medicine. And maybe your family had a tried and true remedy. Ours was a cure for sunburn was black tea. We want to know about what folk remedies your family possibly used. Join the conversation at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. Tiara, one of the focuses of your thesis, though, was to try to change minds of the medical community. And you talked a lot about cultural competence. What does that mean?
Well, just the doctors being aware and opening up that dialogue and just understanding the particular community that they service. You need to know, especially dealing with the Gullah Geechee background, you need to know about their cultural beliefs. These questions need to be asked when they are servicing or helping these particular this particular population and around the world, because a lot of people of color everywhere are using or going back to using traditional medicine, and it just needs to be an open dialogue so that you know, like Ms. Lynn Rivera said, to know when it's time to go to the doctor if you know that the traditional remedy you've been using is not getting the condition under, you know, together.
But some part of the problem is a lack of trust.
A lack of trust, which dates back from slavery. So a lack of that mistrust, and just the family and the culture. You know, it's been passed down. You trust your family more than you trust the outsider. So, you know, just that trust of believing in what your family traditions that's been passed down is safe. You'll believe in that because, you know, people have survived using that. So,
Lynn, do you think that perhaps more acceptance or understanding from the medical community could help to keep folk medicine alive among the Gullah Geechee community?
Well, what I experienced in the store is there are several doctors that frequent the store. They buy natural food. And some of them even use essential oils. I often have customers come in and say that a particular doctor actually referred them to the store to purchase certain herbs or certain essential oils or even certain whole foods. So I think that doctors are really in tune.
So, Tierra, I mean, are there any folk remedies you still use?
I have a daughter. I definitely use the copper penny. Mm-hmm. And I do herbs myself, you know, the sassafras, the life everlasting. If you can get it, because I have connections of getting it. So I still practice a lot of the herbs.
And you want to keep that tradition going with your daughter?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so Lynn, tell me another remedy perhaps that might work really well from your store, as opposed to, say, me coming in and saying, cure my diabetes. What could I come in with that you would actually have a real cure for?
Well, here's something that I find to be very beneficial. Lots of people simply have pain as a result of inflammation, arthritis, tendonitis, carpal tunnel, whatever. I suggest that to them that they simply use turmeric root powder, and this is in a certified organic form, to actually take it, add water, make a paste, apply it to the area of concern, and wrap it. And we find over and over that it's very good for pulling inflammation from the area.
And Tierra is actually nodding her head. Sounds like she agrees with you.
Yes, I do turmeric tea as well. That's great. Yes.
And we got a tweet from Ethan who says, a bar of soap under your leg at night to help leg cramp / pain. My grandfather swore by it and it actually worked for me. In any case, we would love to hear other folk remedies. Our discussion has been with Lynn Rivera of the store Back to Nature in Hilton Head. And Tierra Banks wrote her master's thesis on Gullah Geechee medicine. Lynn and Tierra, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is On Second Thought. Thousands of people in Georgia may lose their food assistance soon. The Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, it's commonly known as SNAP, is about to cut benefits to some residents. And here with details is Sandra Frederick. She's a SNAP program specialist with the Georgia Department of Children and Family Services. Good morning.
Good morning.
Now, this is actually SNAP returning to its former regulations. So let's talk about how SNAP generally works, right? How do you qualify for SNAP? Except in this exception.
SNAP is a means-tested program. When someone comes in, they make application. We look at who's in their household. We look at their income. We look at rent, utilities, and a couple of other factors to determine their eligibility.
Now, before the Great Recession made some changes to SNAP, you needed to have a job to qualify for SNAP, right?
For a certain population called able-bodied adults without dependents, there was a work requirement prior to the recession, so it ended roughly early 2009. So Georgia usually has around 150,000 to 200,000 people who fall into that category. Out of at its height in during the recession, we had 1.8 million to 2 million people on food stamps. So the portion of food stamp participants who actually are subject to this requirement is relatively low.
Okay, so that, yeah, right. So the requirement was waived because unemployment was so high. That's when able-bodied people without dependents. So you're able to work and you don't have kids. During this Great Recession, they made an exception so that you could be unemployed and still qualify.
That's correct. Up until January, the entire state of Georgia was under a waiver. All ABODs were completely waived from this work requirement.
ABOD is able-bodied.
Able-bodied adult without dependents. They were all waived from this work requirement. Beginning January, we had three counties that were no longer eligible for the waiver. That was Cobb County, Gwinnett County, and Hall County.
Why those particular counties?
We get information every year, and the information is about the unemployment rate statewide. Those three counties had a significant decrease in unemployment. Therefore, they did not; they were not eligible to continue with the waiver.
I imagine the thinking is, look, the country is nearly at full employment, so it's not as hard to find a job.
And that's correct. In those three counties, the unemployment rate was low, and the thinking is that we can do something in those counties to assist the able-bodied population and help them find training or work and help them meet their work requirement.
And you said that the number of people actually affected, that this is low. I mean, I saw estimates of maybe 6,000 people.
Yeah, it's very low in those counties. We've got about 6,100 able-bodied adults in those three counties.
So what happens if somebody comes in and applies for SNAP benefits and you say you are an ABOD? I love that term, actually. Mm-hmm. That sounds very cool. But you're an able-bodied person. You don't have dependents, so you don't qualify for SNAP. Then what do you do? Do you send them out or do you send them on to other programs?
No, actually, able-bodied adults have 3 months in 3 years to receive benefits. So in those three counties, when they come in and make application, we let them know what to expect. You've got 3 months. And we also then let them know what we can do to help them meet their work requirement, which would be employment or participating with work or training for 20 hours a week. We then follow that up. We invite them to an orientation. And in that orientation, we discuss, again, the work requirement. And we help. First, we place them into a job search for a couple of weeks. After that, if they're not successful in finding a job, we place them in an activity. And again, we have several nonprofits who have been willing to work with us in trying to, get placements in all three counties. And we also work with the technical colleges for vocational training, adult education, English as a second language, activities like that.
So, in other words, if you go in and get denied, that's not the end of your road.
Yeah, and usually you're not going to get denied. Again, you have 3 months out of 3 years to get benefits, and in that time,
like a bridge.
You have a bridge until that happens to you.
My guest is Sandra Frederick. She works with the SNAP program at the Georgia Department of Children and Family Services. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This month, the Georgia Department of Public Health reported its first case of the Zika virus. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say we can expect more cases. CDC Director Tom Frieden says this virus can spread quickly. Here he is speaking with Fox News.
The bottom line still with Zika is that it's overwhelmingly spread by mosquitoes. And the key lesson, the key message is that if you're pregnant and you're thinking of traveling to a place that has Zika spreading, don't go.
Well, of course, summer is heavy mosquito season in Georgia. And last year, for the second time in a row, Atlanta ranked as the worst city for mosquitoes in the nation. Joining me now is Elmer Gray. He's an entomologist at the University of Georgia in Athens, and he joins me from Savannah, where he's at a meeting, actually, with members of the American Mosquito Control Association. Hi, Elmer.
Hello, good morning.
So how likely is it? Do we have any idea what percentage of mosquitoes might be carrying the Zika virus?
As of right now, very few, we're certain. As summer approaches, there will be potential for mosquitoes to be exposed to it as travelers bring the virus to the United States and to the state of Georgia. But the risk is modest at best, we feel right now.
Pardon my insect ignorance, but do mosquitoes move that far? Can a mosquito from Brazil somehow make it up to the U.S. without traveling on a plane?
Well, no. Other than traveling on a plane, no. Most of the mosquitoes are going to at risk to transmit this disease travel very short distances. Maybe we had the Super Bowl yesterday, 100 yards from where they develop. The risk is that your neighbor travels to Colombia, brings the virus back with them, is exposed to it while in Colombia, brings it back, and then the mosquitoes in your yard or her yard pick it up from your neighbor and transmit it to you. That would be the risk.
Okay, so let's talk about mosquito control. And can I talk first about how to keep from getting bitten by mosquitoes? Because there's been a lot of conflicting evidence about the efficacy of mosquito balms and sprays that you use, whether the mosquitoes are actually turned away by it.
Yeah, this is a really important topic because this is how you prevent any of the mosquito-borne diseases, is to prevent the mosquito bite. So the Environmental Protection Agency's approved repellents are the materials that need to be used. And DEET is still the product of choice. It's approved for very young infants as 2 months of age or older. So it is still the gold standard for mosquito repellents.
So there is a lot of concern among people. There's popular blogs that say DEET is dangerous. It's dangerous for infants. And then, you know, the science is not yet settled yet. What do you have to say to people who say you need to avoid DEET?
DEET has saved more lives than probably most than any of the other public health materials. It's been used since after World War II to prevent malaria and the various diseases in the tropics, and it has long proven to be safe and effective for repelling mosquitoes and preventing mosquito-borne diseases. So you have to be very careful where you get your factual information.
Okay, so then let's talk about the use of DEET. How often do I need to reapply, and do I need to use it all the time, or is there a particular kind of time of day, specifically, say, evening, when I'm more likely to get a mosquito bite, or is it, do I only have to worry about it if I'm walking in the woods?
Well, we can take a step back. You mentioned about what we can do to prevent the bites. Loose-fitting, long sleeves, long pants, light-colored clothes.
But it's so hot in Georgia.
Yeah, but mosquito-borne diseases are serious business, so I understand that. But loose-fitting, the vintage shirts that are produced today are very helpful. Light colors to prevent the silhouette in the environment reduces the potential for mosquito attraction to you. It also reduces your heat. Once you've done that, using insect repellents properly, you want to get good coverage, a little bit on your hands, covering all your skin surfaces. I've been involved in mosquito repellent trials, and if you miss a spot, the mosquitoes will home in on it very quickly.
Really?
So coverage is really important. A small amount goes a long ways. If you're just going to be out for an hour or two, the lowest concentrations and use lightly on your exposed skins is going to work very well to prevent the bites. Then you wash off when you come in at the end of the day, and there's no risk involved. That's the most important thing. If you're going to be out for long periods of time in areas with heavy mosquito infestations, then higher concentrations are more important. But the areas that are at potential risk for transmission of the Zika virus are going to be in your neighborhoods and homes around your close to home, because the mosquitoes that transmit it develop in containers in our neighborhoods, so that close to home and the shorter exposures are probably where you're going to be more concerned.
Does it matter in terms of coverage? Does it matter whether you're using a lotion or a spray?
No. No matter the formulation, complete coverage is key. And with children, you want to spray it on the adult's hands and then rub it on the children. You never want to let your children apply it to themselves.
Okay, so then let's talk about how to prevent mosquitoes from breeding near you. I assume most people know not to have standing water in their backyards, but are there other ways that you can kind of try to keep mosquitoes away from your home?
Well, first off, we start with our window screens and door screens. These are hugely important in our first line of defense, and we really, you know, they fall by the wayside. We forget about them, but they're hugely important, and they need to be fixed up before the weather starts turning warm and you want to throw the windows open and get some fresh air in the home. So the screens on your doors and windows are huge. Other than that, you know, since West Nile arrived in 1999, we've been trying to educate the public about the need to eliminate containers around their homes and yards. And there's segments of our society that are hard to reach. But any kind of standing water will produce mosquitoes. When we've had these nice wet summer last year that we've had and the significant rainfalls of this winter, everything in your yard can hold water, children's toys, buckets, anything. The rain barrels that were so popular in the drought of, you know, 3 or 4 years ago need to be checked regularly, because this is an area that you've put this large container in your yard to catch water for periods of drought. It's a great idea, but they have a huge potential to produce mosquitoes and need to be a focus of our audience's attention.
We're speaking with Elmer Gray. He is an entomologist from the University of Georgia, and he's currently at a meeting with the American Mosquito Control Association. What are you talking about? What's the topic of conversation there at the Mosquito Control Association meeting?
Well, that's a great question. Mosquito control has come a long ways from the days of our youth and in the past when you think of a spray truck. It's an integrated process now that's highly integrated with science, and we try to educate people about things like this, eliminating containers around their homes. Then we use source reduction, and then the various steps of mosquito suppression. So there's all aspects of the science related to mosquito control. Unfortunately, you know, the topics are turned in 2 to 3 months ahead of time, so the Zika virus will be the topic of conversation outside the meeting rooms. Inside the meeting rooms, it'll be more of the science related to mosquito control and biology.
You know, Elmer, I wonder, one of the topics that I keep seeing come up in National Geographic, at nature.com, is people starting to ask, are mosquitoes necessary to the ecology? I'm sure you've seen this. Are you guys talking? Are entomologists talking about this?
I can't say that it's brought up much by the entomologist, but it's a question I get a lot with my presentations that I make as my role as public health extension specialist. And the larvae are a key part of the aquatic ecosystem. They gather small particles as a food source. They become a food source for the other larger fish and insects in the system. As a mosquito control profession, we're trying to suppress mosquitoes. We are never going to get rid of all of them, so there's not a risk that they're going to be eliminated from the ecosystem. We're just trying to keep the populations down to a reasonable and tolerable level.
Although, I mean, seriously, if you Google, are mosquitoes necessary, Elmer, you'll see a ton of people who are asking, do we really need them? Would it really be so bad if we killed all the mosquitoes? You're saying it's probably not even possible.
It's definitely not possible.
But in the meantime, your best advice to people at this point is to wear loose-fitting, long-sleeve clothing and pants and cover themselves in a good repellent.
Yes, and use the repellents with moderation. Follow the instructions closely on the label. That's, as with any chemical, that's hugely important. But eliminate the sources. Be diligent. It's something that people just really don't understand, that the diligence is necessary to remove the containers in the community and in their yards. Myself, I have an active yard with a lot of gardening and things, and I constantly catch my own yard producing mosquitoes. So everyone needs to be extra diligent as we approach this mosquito season.
That is Elmer Gray. He's an entomologist with the University of Georgia. Thank you so much, Elmer.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
There's actually a lot of research going on around the Zika virus, and some of it is being done here in Georgia. UGA researchers are trying to develop a Zika virus vaccine. The announcement about that work was made last week. That's just a couple days after the World Health Organization declared Zika a global health emergency. Ted Ross oversees UGA's Center for Vaccines and Immunology, and he says there's still a lot we just don't know about this virus.
It's been around and been known about since the 1940s, but, you know, something may have changed in this virus more recently that caused it to become more easily transmittable between mosquitoes and humans. And since it's come to the Americas, it's unclear whether or not it's just found a nice environment to replicate in, or whether it is something that's actually changed in the virus itself to make it more pathogenic or cause some of these problems.
Ross says it is unclear when a vaccine could be ready for the public, although that process generally takes quite a long time. His team is working on developing a vaccine with a biotech company in Smyrna, Georgia. If you want to hear more about his research, visit gpb.org to hear an interview that Ted Ross did with Bradley George. And of course, if you have questions about the Zika virus, send them to us through Twitter or Facebook, and we will try to get them answered for you. This is On Second Thought. The Atlanta Opera will offer four main stage productions this year instead of three, and that's a big deal. Why? Because opera is very expensive to produce. It's pretty normal, actually, to have more than 200 people on stage and in the orchestra for one show, not to mention all the people backstage. And if you're presenting something like, say, Wagner's Ring Cycle, forget about it. Opera companies in other cities have closed down in recent years, and that includes some pretty major companies like Opera Pacific, Cleveland Opera, San Antonio Opera, the New York City Opera, which was a shock, and of course the San Diego Opera not that long ago. So what is different in Atlanta? Tomer Zvulin is here to explain what's going right at his company. He's the general and artistic director at the Atlanta Opera. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Celeste. It's a pleasure to see you.
It's a pleasure to see you as well. How long has it been since the Atlanta Opera has offered four main stage productions?
It's been 6 years since four productions on the main stage. And so we're very, very excited to get back on track in that regard.
So basically, you stopped doing main stage, four main stage productions kind of at the beginnings of the Great Recession.
Exactly, yes.
And that's, I don't want to make assumptions, but that's because ticket sales and donations went down?
As you mentioned, opera is an expensive art form, and I think the repercussions of the recession caused the company to scale down on the productions. But what we discovered is that in order for the Atlanta Opera to provide a year-round interest for the community, in order for us to increase the quality of our productions, our orchestra, our chorus, and in order to allow ourselves to perform diverse repertoire, it is a great idea to have more than three productions. Now, as a matter of fact, the Atlanta Opera increased the number of productions from three to four in 2014-15, three main stage plus a Discovery series. And this past year, the 15-16 season, we increased to five, three main stage and two
plus
Discovery,
the Discovery series.
And what's great about the Discovery series is that it allowed us to expand, increase the artistic risk while lowering the financial risk. And you might say, what does that mean? So the idea behind that is that it allows us to do additional productions, some of them more adventurous, let's say, in terms of repertoire, such as Three Decembers by Jake Heggie, Soldier Songs by David T. Little, while reducing the financial risk. In other words, those are chamber operas that can be produced on a smaller scale and therefore allow us to lower the financial risk. However, when we look at next season, the financial situation is getting better in America. More people come to see our shows. Our production of Pirates of Penzance in March is selling more tickets than we've ever seen, actually. And this great hope for both the economy and for Atlanta Opera allows us to expand our main stage and get back to four productions, plus two Discovery series, which will continue their operations.
I want to kind of dispel a myth. Yes, opera is very expensive produced, but there's also this assumption that opera tickets are very expensive, and that is not true. I can say that categorically that actually I paid quite a bit more for my tickets to Book of Mormon at the Fox Theater than I would pay for an opera ticket.
Oh, and you haven't even seen Hamilton yet in New York City.
Yeah, exactly. That's the musical. I have not yet, but hundreds of dollars you can spend easily.
Yeah.
Lazarus tickets, which is the David Bowie musical, are selling for upwards of $1,300 or more. But I want to explain for people who have no experience with opera why opera can be so expensive, because it's not just the size of the cast, but there's a couple interesting things. Number one, almost everybody in the pit who plays in the orchestra and almost every singer that you see on stage has an advanced degree. Like you're hiring very highly skilled and trained professionals, right?
Yes.
That's not cheap.
Exactly. I first want to dispel the myth that opera tickets are very expensive. As you mentioned, it's important to say that students and rush tickets are going on for $20 for our productions. And so I think that that's is totally doable for a lot of people. The reason for the priciness of opera productions are exactly the things that you mentioned. Number one, over 200, sometimes 300 people participate in every production. 60 people, 70 people are on stage as the chorus. 10 principals from all over the world, an orchestra that often reaches 80 musicians, and an army backstage of stagehands, wigs and makeup, stage managers.
And that's not
people.
Even the non-speaking roles and the ballet corps that you sometimes have.
That's the tip of the iceberg. Now, in addition to that, opera is known for its scale. It's not only the amount of people that are participating, it's also scale of opera is grand. That's why people like to come see it. The sets are magnificent. There are multimedia and projections often involved in our productions. The costumes, if we do a show from the 18th century, are very detailed with the finest fabrics, the wigs and makeup, as I mentioned, the lighting. Everything is very detailed and very expensive, and scale cost. And that's why we love opera, because it's the grandest scale of all.
So how am I to interpret the fact that you guys are doing better? One of the problems that we've had in classical music in general is reaching younger audiences. Is Atlanta Opera finding younger people to come?
I think that there are a few answers to this question. I think that you're unpacking a lot of discussion here. Number one is that our Discovery series in the past 2 years have shown us that there is appetite for different repertoire in Atlanta. There's sophistication from the audience, and they're eager to see more opera and different kinds of opera. That's number one. Number two, the change in our approach to opera, both on the main stage and in the Discovery series, allowed us to connect to more audience, to younger audience. And that approach can be summed in one sentence. We believe in the renaissance of opera in America. And what that means is that our main stage productions, which often shows popular shows, will always approach those from a fresh, imaginative and innovative way, new interpretations for masterpieces. And our Discovery series will approach opera as a new art form, where American opera, which is alive and kicking right now with many composers, talented composers that are writing a lot of pieces, American opera has never been more interesting. And we believe that it has a big role in the repertoire of the Atlanta Opera in the future.
There's a number of measures. I wanted to get this number correctly, that in fact opera is the fastest growing of the performing arts. More than 20 million people attend at least one opera every single year. And in fact, one of the fastest growing audiences for opera is Generation X. That's 18 to 30-year-olds at this point, which has grown more than 18%, almost 20% in recent years. Now, I do have to mention, I'm a professional opera singer, so I have skin in the game, and I'm slightly biased on this issue. I just want to be totally clear about that. So you were mentioning one of the reasons people would come to opera when you could just listen to a CD or watch it in on Netflix. But as far as I know, opera's one of the last places where you can actually hear the unamplified human voice, which is kind of an astounding thing. You do not mic your singers.
I really like your question, Celeste. Welcome to Atlanta. It's great
to
have you here. So one of the things we talk a lot about is the fact that opera, unlike any other art form, musical, performing arts art form, is non-amplified. And as you know, as a classically trained vocalist, opera singers need to be able to convey the most delicate emotions with a voice and go over an orchestra of 80 or 90 and reach the top seats in a house that has 2,600 seats without amplification. Now, I will qualify this by saying that sometimes we do amplify singers when it comes to dialogue and dialogue alone. So, for example, our production of Pirates of Penzance, while the voices will not be amplified when they're singing, when there is a dialogue, it's extremely difficult to get to 2,600.
It's spoken dialogue. In those operettas, they speak. And in some operas also, they don't sing everything. They speak some of the lines.
Exactly. But generally speaking, one of the wondrous things about opera is the fact that it's not amplified.
Let's talk about another opera that you guys are bringing to the stage. And it's kind of funny to me because this premiered back in 2011, and yet in the opera world, this is still seen as a new opera. This is called Silent Night. This is based on the Christmas Truce of 1914, which is an event that we've talked about here on this show. It happened during World War I, in which soldiers from both sides came up out of the trenches and met in the middle because it was Christmas. Now, the composer of this describes it as sort of an anti-war message. He says, quote, "War is not sustainable when you come to know your enemy as a person." Is that how you view this opera?
Absolutely. And, you know, this is an opera that is very close to my heart. I spent 3 years in the army, in the Israeli Defense Army, and have been through a lot of experience there that relates to battles and war and just violence. And doing something like Silent Night that talks about the friendship that can happen between enemies, and that Christmas truce is such a classic story and moving event that actually happened in World War I, when the French, the Scottish, and the Germans are all together in the trenches fighting each other, and they all, for one brief evening, come together to sing Christmas songs, drink brandy and have chocolate and play soccer famously, is one of the most moving events in history. And so Kevin Putz taking this story and translating it into an epic, melodic, operatic event. First of all, he won the Pulitzer Prize as soon as it came out. It
was his done, first opera, and he wins a Pulitzer.
Yeah, it was incredible. And then it's done in so many cities like Philadelphia, Minnesota, Cincinnati. I was lucky enough to do the European premiere at the Wexford Opera Festival in 2014. And the production itself went on to win two theater awards in Ireland. So we feel very lucky to be able to bring that specific production, the second production in the history of the opera, and perform it here in Atlanta. It also will have a performance on Veterans Day and celebrate the involvement of veterans in wars, and whether it's the War of Iraq or World War II, or in this case, World War I. Celebrating veterans is something that is very important for me, and I believe for the community as well.
So I want to get back to this kind of essential question about what's different in Atlanta than it is in all these other cities. I mentioned that the close in the New York City Opera was shocking, and that's understating what kind of an earthquake that was among classical music professionals. We have seen some iconic companies close over the past 5 to 10 years. Why not Atlanta? What's different here?
I think that we can approach every issue in the world from a pessimistic or an optimistic view. And while there are companies that didn't do so well, sometimes it's relating to the financial crisis. Sometimes it's relating to not being able to be flexible enough to change when change is needed. I will also encourage us to look at the optimistic view and see companies that are thriving and are doing so well, like Chicago, that are selling more tickets than they've ever done before, Glimmer Glass Festival that is becoming one of the most important festivals in the United States. And I think that the through line for successful opera companies is being able to recognize we live in a very visual era where it's as important to people to see things as much as it is for them to hear things. Opera is based on its core on oral experience, on the greatest music and the greatest voices in the world. But in the 21st century, when audiences are sophisticated to the degree that they can watch anything they can ever want to in a click of a mouse in their phones, we have to make sure that opera develops in such a way that it's as visual and theatrical as it is musical. And I think that companies that are doing well are companies that understand that. What we've been doing in the past 3 years, and we're not alone on this, I mentioned a few companies like that, it's a trend on an international level, is to make sure that operatic productions are appealing to young, sophisticated audience of the 21st century. Now, we must not neglect the core audience, the fanatic opera audience, has been coming to the opera for decades. But that is not going to happen because opera will never lose its core. Opera is based on music and on voices, and that's why it survived for the past 400 years.
Tomas Voulin is the General and Artistic Director of the Atlanta Opera. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Celeste.
We have more information about the 2016 season of the Atlanta Opera. It's at our Facebook page. It's facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. That's our show for today. Tomorrow we will talk about breed-specific dog bans. Some places in Georgia have moved to ban or restrict pit bulls. Do you think bans like that are a good idea? Should pit bulls be prohibited by law? Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. We're also on Twitter at OSTTalk or post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.